It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state DNR says people are throwing away too much food and recyclables. We'll find out how that waste can become a problem and how we can reduce our landfill footprint. First, a Texas law banning abortions after the sixth week of pregnancy is making the fight over access to abortions a top political issue in states around the country. Anti-abortion advocates have a new momentum after the U.S. Supreme Court allowed that law to take effect last week, though the court has not yet issued a final ruling on the law's constitutionality. And lawmakers in states around the country are starting to advance similar laws. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Texas abortion law? Do you want to see other states implement something along those lines? Or do you want to see it turned around maybe in the courts? And do you want to see this, whichever side of the issue or no side you're on, do you think it should be a key issue, a bigger issue in the 2022 midterm elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, you've been talking to people in the abortion rights debate. What kind of things are you hearing about what Texas is going to mean for other states around the country?
Well, it's huge for the anti-abortion movement, and it has a lot of abortion rights advocates and providers really scared, because basically the Supreme Court has approved or essentially looked the other way at this Texas law, and it's going to provide a model now for other states to put in place similar laws, because that's how a lot of these anti-abortion laws spread, is one state is successful, and then you see copycat laws start to go up in other states. And so, you know, this will lead to other states trying to copy Texas, but it also just gives momentum for other states to move forward on other anti-abortion laws that they're trying to do, so-called trigger laws, where abortion bans go into place if Roe v. Wade is overturned, for example, other types of six-week bans. And it really, you know, the legislative sessions for most legislatures are out of session right now until 2022. And so that's when you're going to see a lot of this pick up.
One of the unique things about this Texas law isn't just the 6 week timeline here, banning abortions after that 6 weeks, but the enforcement, having citizens sue, in effect, bring suits and report to organizations that either perform abortions or that might, or individuals who aid a woman seeking an abortion. Are other states looking at that aspect of it as something that might pass the courts? Because the deal is state officials don't directly enforce this law.
Right. That's why this is so unique. It's meant, they wrote it in this very tricky way that makes it very hard to challenge legally. So you can't, as it doesn't technically criminalize abortion, it just bans abortions, and it doesn't go after the woman who is getting an abortion, but it goes after, you know, it could be a doctor, a driver, like a cab driver, or an Uber driver who drops the woman off at the clinic, maybe even a friend who helps her. And the intent is essentially to scare everyone, so that it becomes people become too afraid of lawsuits. And so the infrastructure of providing abortions just crumbles. And so Florida and Arkansas are already working on their own Texas style bills. But, you know, one thing that we've been reporting on since I'm in Washington is that it's been interesting that you would think something like this, that the anti-abortion movement considers such a victory, you didn't hear a lot from national Republicans cheering this law. Someone like Senator Ted Cruz or Senator John Cornyn, Texas's two Republican senators, Ted Cruz especially, you know, obviously a very outspoken social conservative, they were pretty quiet on this law. So they eventually put out statements, but they weren't sort of the victorious ones you would expect. And, you know, I think there's a few reasons for that. You know, we're not quite sure yet, but I think there is some concern that how could something like this Texas law be used in other ways? Could it be used to deputize private citizens to go after gun owners, or, you know, other types of things that Republicans might not like? And so the implications of this and how it spreads beyond abortion will be interesting to watch.
It's the week in Washington. We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Amanda Turkle with us this week from HuffPost. Right now, talking about the Texas abortion law, possible similar laws coming in states around the country. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So my thoughts on the Texas abortion law. I personally feel that the Texas state Republicans, the state house there, I think they should be, you know, absolutely ashamed. I think this is a horrible law. Many doctors now in Texas are recommending that women there get pregnancy tests every 4 to 6 weeks. Because most women don't actually know they're pregnant that early on in the pregnancy. And if we look at the history of abortion in the country and abortion in other countries where it's historically been limited or illegal, all this really is going to accomplish is A, yeah, scare people, but B, it's going to make things more expensive. It's going to make things more dangerous for women in Texas. And it's probably, if it sticks around for long enough, it may even result in death.
Michael, thanks for the call. Getting some weird noise on your line there, but I think we take your point. Amanda, are these some of the concerns that we're hearing from pro-choice groups about the possible impact of this Texas law?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, this law, but also just this fear that the Supreme Court now with Amy Coney Barrett and this, you know, majority of conservatives will overturn Roe v. Wade. Many women and men remember what the country was like before Roe v. Wade and when you couldn't get abortions and when the procedure was incredibly dangerous because you had to do it in secret. It led to a lot of medical problems and it led to deaths. And that's what people are afraid of. And, you know, obviously there are some states now that have laws protecting the right to abortion, but not every state does. I thought the caller made an important point about this 6 week time period. Governor of Texas, Greg Abbott said, you know, look, you have 6 weeks to be able to get an abortion. We're not banning abortion, but many women don't even know that they're pregnant. By that 6 week point, you sort of have to be trying to get pregnant and checking all the time, and then you might catch it. But if you're not trying to get pregnant, you might not know, and then it's too late. And it's important to note too, that this abortion ban, does not provide exceptions for pregnancies that result from rape or incest. And, Abbott's other response to this was that, well, Texas will work tirelessly to make sure we eliminate all rapists from the streets of Texas, which I don't think provides women that much comfort. I think people have tried to get rid of rape, but, you know, that's not really the solution here.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Amanda, I know the midterm elections are 14 months away. There's no way to predict what the key issues are going to be, obviously, this far out. But that said, is there a thought that this Texas law and the Supreme Court, at least for now, letting it go ahead, shakes things up, moves abortion up, at least on the issue list for the upcoming elections?
Yes, absolutely. We're going to be closely watching abortion and how it plays. You know, it could, you know, I would expect that we will see Republican candidates be asked, you know, whether or not they support this Texas law. Democrats are obviously going to have to talk about abortion as well. And it will be interesting to see, you know, especially depending on what the Supreme Court does, you know, does this motivate Democrats or Republicans more to turn out and vote on the issue of abortion? And, you know, the midterm elections are a little bit away, but we do have this year in November, the Virginia state races. And the one that everyone's watching is the race for governor. And you have a Republican candidate there, Glenn Youngkin, who, you know, privately, and he was caught on video saying that he is all in and will go on offense if he's elected to stop abortion, but he just can't talk about it right now because he's trying to win over independents. And so something like this Texas law is really not something he wants to be talking about, and it will put him in an awkward place.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Appleton. John, hi.
Hi, thank you for letting me talk to you. I don't think people realize how frequent miscarriages are. We've had some in our family recently, and then you mention, and oh yeah, she did, and this doesn't just apply to those first 6 weeks. Any woman who has a pregnancy and all of a sudden the pregnancy is not there, people are going to say, aha, we will sue. Prove that you didn't have an abortion. And if you think it's something that's, I mean, it's a time of sorrow.
John, thanks for sharing that story. Sorry to hear about your experiences, but Amanda, has that concern been raised? A woman who has a miscarriage possibly being pursued, investigated to see whether it was in fact an abortion?
Yes. People under the Texas law receive incentives, financial incentives, to go after and sort of to sue, people who help a woman get an abortion. And these could be completely frivolous lawsuits. The people who are doing the suing don't actually even have to live in Texas. But it doesn't matter if their suit is dismissed, if it's a frivolous lawsuit, there's no penalty for these people, and the other side doesn't get any damages. And so it's entirely tilted in favor of ordinary random people who oppose abortion just bringing suits. And again, you could do that to harass someone. You could do it in a time of great pain for someone. It doesn't really matter. And it could, obviously the potential here for problems is great.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost, with us for our weekly roundup of the top political stories in Washington. Coming up, we'll hear from a couple more of you about this Texas abortion law. We'll move on then to some other topics, including prescription medicine prices and letting Medicare negotiate prescription drug costs. You can join in on at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Week in Washington conversation with Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, looking at some of the top stories in national news. Back to a couple more of your calls on the Texas abortion law, what it means for the country. Let's go to Wendy now in Neenah. Wendy, hi.
Rob, thanks for covering this topic, Rob. First of all, thank you to all the men who have called in. They've had some very good points as far as this being a women's reproductive health problem. With the law enacted across our country, they are making it harder and harder for women to take care of their health. I'd also like to point out, most women, that's not your first choice, is to have an abortion. The best way to prevent abortion is to have affordable birth control. And I guess that's all I wanted to point out.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Wendy's sharing her opinion there and wanting some focus on things like affordable birth control, Amanda.
Yes, and I think another thing that is, often doesn't get talked about is that, if you want to incur, the women who get abortions are often low income and women of color. And if they decide to or are forced to keep the child, there aren't always the services in place to help them, to provide that child with a healthy life, social services, food assistance, whatever it is, those aren't in place. And that's not something that Texas is expanding right now, which people say, if you're really interested in making sure, if you're really pro-life, and if you're really interested in making sure that these babies have a healthy, fulfilling life, this is something you need to be doing as well.
Thanks for the call. We'll take one more call on the issue. Ron is with us in Madison. Ron, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today? Thanks for taking my call. It's an interesting topic, and first I can say that while it may not sound like it, I don't believe that my feelings on this subject are outliers. I think that more people believe the way I do. I am pro-choice and anti-abortion simultaneously. People like us don't usually speak up about this, but I believe it's a woman's right to choose, but I also am anti-abortion. I also agree completely. Using this type of law and with the enforcement capabilities that they're doing in Texas, allowing private citizens basically to act as police and bring suit and bring reporting, is just opening up a can of worms that nobody really wants to go to. On the other hand, I am interested because, conversely, nobody ever talks about this from a pro-choice standpoint. If 6 weeks is not enough time, what is enough time?
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. And Amanda, legislatures and courts have set deadlines later than that six-week time period, right, that have, I believe, passed constitutional muster.
Right, exactly. Viability usually at about 7 months, 28 weeks, 24 weeks. You know, it's 6 weeks is far less than that. I think you have some people who argue that, you know, it should be completely left up to women to decide this. But, you know, 6 weeks, this is the strictest law in the nation. There have been other legislatures that have tried to get at 6 week bans, but none of them have gone into effect. Courts have stopped them. They haven't made it all the way through the legislature. This is the first one that's actually gone into effect because it had a willing Supreme Court and it had this this sort of legal runaround. But, you know, what the caller was saying, too, and it gets back to something the previous caller was saying, you know, this is abortion is not the first choice for many women. Although, you know, if it is, like, it's their choice. But, you know, this is a tough decision that a woman makes with her family, with her doctor. And, you know, people, you know, a majority of people think in the country support access to some sort of abortion. What the Texas ban does, despite what Greg Abbott says, a six-week ban is essentially a full ban for many women.
Thanks for the call, Ron. We're talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, looking at some top stories in national politics. Want to move on to a couple other issues, Amanda. This effort in Congress now to enable Medicare to negotiate prescription drug costs with drug companies. People have been talking about this for a long time. Some of your colleagues reported on a unique effort to stop that from drug companies and labor groups. What's going on?
Yeah. So first of all, it's called HR3. That's the legislation. This is something Joe Biden has said is a central part of his agenda. He's committed to passing it. And it's something that has support from a majority of Americans. I saw some recent poll, 81%, that includes a majority of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. So this is something that's widely popular. You know, I think if you ask most people, do you want lower prescription drug prices, they'll say yes. But there are these ads running right now that's urging people to vote against it, saying it will cost America thousands of jobs and stifle innovation. And it's being run by this advocacy group, the Pharmaceutical Industry Labor Management Association. It's a group of the pharmaceutical industry and a group of unions. And they are running these ads, asking their member of Congress to oppose this. And so we reported on this effort because I don't think a lot of people realizing unions, which are often considered more democratic, are teaming up with the pharmaceutical industry. Some of these unions, when we reached out to them, said that they didn't actually seem to know about this yet. And they said that they didn't support it. Others didn't have any comment. But I think one thing it shows is that, you know, there are differences in the labor movement. There are unions that are more that are sort of more liberal, and there are ones that are the building trades unions, which often tend to be a little bit more conservative and place more emphasis on, you know, we will support the industry that is providing us jobs, even if it means, you know, giving in on something like this. But coming out against this big pillar of Biden's agenda is a pretty big step forward, even for these unions.
Let's give a listen to part of one of those ads.
Skilled union workers and scientists came together to develop vaccines and defeat COVID-19. But bad policy proposals like HR3 and similar provisions being considered in the U.S. Senate will put their jobs in jeopardy. It will cost America thousands of jobs, stifle innovation and discovery of new medicines, and put barriers between patients and their medications.
And that's the typical argument from pharmaceutical companies against this kind of law. But the labor angle, these are building trades people who, I guess, build the facilities that the pharmacy companies are researching in. Is that the connecting the dots here?
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
So how big a stumbling block is it to have even part of the labor movement for the Biden administration? Is it to have part of the labor movement trying to block this?
It's not ideal, especially because, you know, Joe Biden has been such a big friend of labor. You know, one of the unions on the board of this group is the International Association of Firefighters. They have been big Biden supporters and were during his campaign. So, you know, this isn't great for Biden, this look that some of these unions are opposing him. But like I said, we talked to some of these groups and they were, they said that they didn't really support this. They didn't know about it. So it's not clear if they're going to fight very hard for this, whereas obviously the pharmaceutical industry will. And like you said, this is something we hear from the pharmaceutical industry all the time, that this is going to cost jobs. This is going to hurt innovation. You know, the American people are the ones who are ultimately going to lose out. And the pharmaceutical industry has huge lobbying power in Washington. And so they're going to be spending a lot of money to defeat this. And whereas I don't think the unions ultimately will probably be putting all their muscle behind it.
And just in our last minute, you've been following the question of which states are going to accept Afghan refugees under the special immigrant visa program for Afghans who worked with the U.S. over the last 20 years. What are you seeing from states?
So we surveyed all the states and we heard back from almost all of them. 37 states had told us they were willing to take in refugees. Two said they weren't, and then the rest, 11, said didn't give us a response. And so the two that aren't going to are Wyoming and South Dakota. They said they have no interest in taking refugees. Of the 37 who will, you know, some of them said, sure, we'll take them if the federal government tells us we have to. But there were others that, you know, obviously who, you know, and we've heard about some of these states said, you know, we will welcome these people with open arms. They helped the U.S. efforts in Afghanistan. You know, they're welcome to come to our states. And that includes both Republican and Democratic governors have said that. And, you know, one thing to note is that this is a huge difference from when Obama in 2015, he wanted to settle 10,000 refugees from Syria's civil war in the United States. The GOP members of Congress tried to ban that, and 30 governors said that the refugees would not be welcome. And so, you know, there's a lot more support for resettling the Afghan refugees.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost, with us for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. After a new study, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wants people to do a better job of recycling and composting. The agency spent some time over the past year sifting through trash samples at 14 landfills around the state. Here's what they found. The most common type of item, food. In fact, 30% was either stuff that had been edible or scraps, you know, your banana peels. And by the way, food can be kind of bad in landfills. 21% was paper products, 17% was plastic. The DNR says many of those things could have been recycled and are recycled, assuming we do our part. So how can we cut down on what we send to the landfill? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you sort your trash and recycling? If not, how come? Do you compost? Are you able to compost? Do you have a setup where you can do it? Tell us about it. Do you do things to try to minimize your landfill footprint? Or do you have a question about what ends up where and why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Casey Lemensky is the Solid Waste Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, can you tell us how we do this kind of landfill survey? We got our hands dirty. What kind of things do you do to find out what's out there?
Sure. So this is a study that we've tried to do about every 10 years. This is now our third study. And we actually contracted with SES engineers to lead the study. And so this study included going to 14 different landfills that take 72% of the state's municipal solid waste or general solid waste. So it's a pretty representative sample. And then took a number of samples from each of those locations to total 398. Those were 200-pound samples. And then those samples were hand-sorted into 85 different waste categories to give us a percent total that each of those categories represents in our landfills in 2020.
Let's tackle a couple of those categories. Now, as I mentioned, the big winner here, I guess, was food-related stuff, wasted food that somebody could have eaten at some point, and food scraps. First of all, Why is it bad if we end up with a lot of this organic material in our landfills?
Sure. So organic material that goes to the landfill is compressed with all the other waste because landfill space is very valuable. So it needs to be put under high compression. And in doing so, it pushes all of the oxygen out of the landfill. So that means that the food that, you know, when it's breaking down in other places, it breaks down aerobically or with oxygen, is breaking down anaerobically or without oxygen in the landfill. And then that means it's broken down by other microorganisms, and those microorganisms off-put methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's 28 times more powerful than CO2. And landfills, you know, are required to collect this gas, but it is difficult over, you know, these several acre facilities to do that. And so the best thing that we can do is to keep it from being generated by keeping it out of the landfills in the first place. And also because, you know, food waste has a lot of higher, better uses than just going to the landfill. It can be going to feed hungry people or potentially for animal feed or to facilities that are specifically designed to process it in those anaerobic settings and then collect the gas and use it as a renewable fuel, or to be made into compost, which has a lot of great potential benefits for soil and water retention.
And you give some advice in your press release on this study. And one piece of advice, if people want to cut down food waste, is to waste less food. How can we think ahead, you know, when we're shopping and try to say, okay, I'm gonna make sure I'm not buying a bunch of stuff that's going to end up in the landfill?
Yes. You know, it is something that's very hard. I know I personally struggle with it, but there are some simple steps that can be made. And especially if maybe, you know, those steps are taken one at a time so that they become a habit and, you know, we can slowly build up to it. I think we can all make a big difference. So some of those simple steps are, yes, as you mentioned, shopping with a plan for what you're going to be actually using that week, and probably giving yourself a little wiggle room to not make a very extravagant meal that maybe sounds like a good plan at the grocery store for every week if you're anything like me. And then to learn how to properly store those items when you get home, which can be, you know, taking them maybe out of their packaging that they came in from the grocery store and storing them some other way, or as simple as just making sure you know how to use different areas of your refrigerator and the humidity controls on your refrigerator to extend the life of those materials as long as possible. And then, you know, there's a lot of great tools out there that can help us be creative with trying to minimize this waste. Some are like alternative item generators that you can find online instead of buying, you know, a whole bag of something new, you know, using something you already have or, you know, have in your refrigerator, or meal generators. If you have a couple of things that seem like they need to be used up soon, you know, finding a meal that combines those two items. And then a feature that I definitely like to encourage is the Food Keeper app from USDA, which looks at, and there are other tools for this as well, but it helps you keep track of when food is still safe to eat. And that's important because the expiration, use by, and best by date labels on our food are actually manufacturer dates that were put on those products for quality, but not necessarily food safety, except for infant formula.
Talking to Casey Lemensky, solid waste coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about a landfill survey, finding out what we're throwing away and why a lot of what we throw away, food waste and recyclables, shouldn't end up in the landfill and what we can do instead. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, what you do. Do you compost, for example, or your questions? That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kathy is with us in Janesville. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
I work for a large employer here in the state of Wisconsin, and I work on the staff that takes care of the waste products and recyclables. And one problem that we have is the people, the other employees, who are depositing their refuse, either in taking that choice of either the trash or the different recycle bin, they're not making apparently the correct decisions of when they're disposing their material, because they're putting like partially filled bottles of beverages and the styrofoam food containers that still have food into the recyclable choices. But when that happens and we pull those clear bags out of the bins and we see that, we have to actually determine that that's trash because there's still contaminants in it. And unfortunately, the public is, we find that is not really aware of how to actually present your recyclable for recycling.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Casey, how big a problem is just plum recycling confusion?
It's a very big problem, and thanks for your work, Kathy, and helping to sort those materials out. You know, it's something that we need to do constant education on. One of the reasons it is more confusing, definitely, than I would like, is because what is recyclable is not universal. It depends on what facility those particular items are going to, and whether they have, you know, both the equipment to manage those materials and also the buyers for those end materials. And that can vary, you know, even between your work and your home, between, you know, home and school, or your home and, you know, your friend's or neighbor's home, depending on the recycling facility that it's using. So it's really important to make sure that whoever you're working with recycling is providing clear communication on what specifically they are taking, and it's kept up to date. One thing that is nice about Wisconsin's program, even though some of the materials vary facility to facility, there are certain materials that are required to be and able to be recycled everywhere across the state. And so you can always know with confidence in Wisconsin that those materials can go in the bin and will go for recycling once they're sorted. And those would be your office paper, newspaper, magazine paper, cardboard, aluminum containers, plastic containers with a resin code 1 or 2, that is PET or HDPE, and glass containers and steel and bimetal containers. So those are universal across the state. They can go in any bin, but otherwise be looking for signage and, you know, or local information from your provider. And if it isn't there, you know, if you can reach out to someone like in Kathy's role that is involved and, you know, can get information from your specific hauler. We do have signage available on our website and outreach materials that are available in a few different languages that at least cover those mandatory recyclables that anyone could print or ask for copies of to put up and display anywhere they're trying to use it. But for those additional materials, it's best to ask locally.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about a new Wisconsin DNR study about what's in our landfills and people's trash and recycling habits. Casey Lemensky stays with us, solid waste coordinator for the Department of Natural Resources. We've posted links to the DNR's composting and recycling guides. You can find those links at WPR.org/centraltime. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you manage the trash and recycling at your house or workplace? Do you compost food scraps of one sort or another? Do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about our trash and recycling habits in Wisconsin. The state DNR says people can do a better job of composting and recycling. It found lots of cardboard, plastic, and food waste in landfills around the state that would have been better off in other places. Casey Lemensky is with us, solid waste coordinator for the DNR. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your habits when it comes to recycling, your composting experience, or your questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go now to Margaret with us in Appleton. Margaret, hi.
Hi there. I just moved with my family from Milwaukee to Appleton, and when we lived in Milwaukee, we used Compost Crusaders, a company that would pick up your compost from the curb once a week in the summer and biweekly in the winter, and that was a great company. I would recommend it if you're not ready to do it yourself there in the backyard. And they help you to, you know, monitor, like keep track of how much you've diverted. I think we diverted about 2,000 pounds of waste in the last little over a year. And now we're in Appleton, and I'm living in an apartment, and I'm just throwing away corn husks and all the little peels and, you know, bones from meat, trying to figure out if there's anything up there that we can do, because I don't have any space that I could even compost on my own if I were up for the challenge.
Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. It's a great question. And so in Milwaukee, she had this service. I've got a little yard, and I've got room, Casey, for a composter. I can throw all my veggie scraps in there pretty much. What about somebody in Margaret's situation now? Apartment building. You can't put up a composter of your own. Are there options for people to compost?
Yeah, thanks for composting when you can. There are a few programs throughout the state that do offer that type of subscription service, curbside composting, which is, you know, where people can reach out and contract themselves, or restaurants can. Unfortunately, I don't know of any in the Appleton area. We definitely want to see an increase in that infrastructure to help us divert some of these materials. You know, backyard composting is wonderful because it is local and, you know, doesn't need additional transportation or processing. But large scale composting allows you to compost more materials, and also is the only option for people, as you mentioned, in apartment settings a lot of times, or with other, you know, reasons, space reasons, or potentially even animal reasons. For not being able to compost. And, you know, we just need to see that infrastructure expand. We have only a handful of compost facilities that are currently taking food waste, and they can process the material well. A lot of them, the reason they, facilities that take primarily yard waste now, the reason that they don't want to expand is because of contamination concerns. Mm-hmm. And that it has been some of the reasons that, you know, other programs have not moved forward. And so it's something that we really want to see move forward to try and keep some of this material out of the landfill, but it's still a young industry in Wisconsin. And I think the best thing to try and encourage it is to make sure when those options are being used, we're keeping the material as clean as possible. And also, you know, to go ahead and ask locally for that type of service and business, to let, you know, your city or, you know, other composters that maybe offer only drop-off services know that that's something you'd be interested in. And so we can see an expansion of that and keep those materials from the landfill.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Casey Lemensky, Solid Waste Coordinator for the DNR, about how to keep stuff out of landfills. Food scraps, stuff that can be recycled. You could still join in at 800-642-1234. Casey, before we go back to callers, one thing that struck me in the study, you didn't just go to landfills. You also talked to people around Wisconsin and found out that there's, I guess, a sort of recycling skepticism. People who believe that even if they separate their stuff and they do it right, it's all going to end up in the same place anyway. What do you say to them?
Yeah, so it was actually a separate survey that we'll be also releasing the results of. It was a household survey on recycling and electronics recycling habits around the state. But one bullet point from that that's very relevant to the results of our characterization study was a question on if you don't recycle, why? And we saw the highest response received on that survey was belief that it ends up being landfilled anyway. And that is something, you know, I think there's been a lot of awareness from people that recycling has changed in the last couple of years, and that also recycling alone is not enough, which I completely agree with. You know, we need to also stop using a lot of single-use disposable materials and plastics in particular. Plastics overall were 17% by weight of what we put in the landfill we found in this survey. Those plastics are all plastics. We found that 5.7% of what's put in the landfill in the survey are the recyclable plastics that everyone has the ability to recycle statewide. And we already have the infrastructure for. And those are materials that just aren't being sorted out at the individual level.
I want to jump in and bring one more caller. Sorry, before we run out of time, we've got Kathy with us in Eau Claire. Kathy, hi.
Hi. You may have answered some of this already. I guess I'm just wondering if the DNR can work more or is working more closely with municipalities to require the food scraps be separated. You know, what I've heard is there's like 40% of food scraps make up, you know, the solid waste coming to the landfills, and our landfills are just exploding and expanding constantly to make.
Kathy, thanks for the call. If someone, Casey, wanted to advance their composting in their community, whether they work in local government or a citizen, what kind of resources are out there with the DNR? Just in our last minute.
Sure. The resources that we have available are just directing people to the private, industries that are carrying out compost right now. But like I said, if you want to pursue that, I definitely encourage reaching out to local government to let them know that's a service you want to pursue in your community, and so that we can advance that program.
Thanks for that call. And Casey, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Casey Lemensky, Solid Waste Coordinator for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. We talked to her today about a new study about what is in the state's landfills. Basically, there's a lot of food scraps and there's a lot of stuff that can be recycled. We've got links to DNR pages to help you with your own composting and or recycling efforts. You can find those links at wpr.org/centraltime. Again, that's wpr.org/centraltime for some composting and recycling resources from the state DNR. And you can let us know if you've started some new composting projects. Email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us @centraltimewpr.